Mainstream readings of Numbers have tended to see the book as a haphazard junkyard of material that connects Genesis through Leviticus with Deuteronomy and Joshua, and this composed then at a late stage in the history of ancient Israel. By contrast, Pitkanen reads Numbers as part of a wider work of Genesis through Joshua, as a carefully crafted, programmatic, settler, colonial document for a new society in Canaanite highlands in the late 2nd millennium BCE, a document that seeks to replace pre-existing indigenous societies. On today's show, we speak with Pekka Pitkanen about his new approach to Numbers and his recent book, A Commentary on Numbers, Narrative, Ritual, and Colonialism. That's put out by Routledge in 2017. You're listening to New Books in Biblical Studies, and I'm Michael Morales, your host. Dr. Pekka Pitkanen is a senior lecturer in the School of Liberal and Performing Arts at the University of Gloucestershire in the UK. He holds a PhD in Old Testament Studies from the University of Gloucestershire. He's the author of Central Sanctuary and Centralization of Worship in Ancient Israel, put out in 2003, and a commentary on the Book of Joshua in 2010. His main area of specialization is the study of the sacred texts of Christianity, the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible, in the context of the ancient world and from a number of perspectives, including archaeology, sociology, and anthropology. Pekka, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us about yourself, Pekka, and how you came to write on Numbers.
Okay. Well, I am a person whose background is in Finland. That's where I grew up, and I was destined to a career in sort of more like science and engineering, and I did studies in computer science, studying in an applied physics program. But then after I completed my studies, I was interested in working abroad, and I ended up working in South Korea. It's a kind of long story how that all happened. And there I got into theological studies. I had always an interest in religion. And then I did a Master's of Divinity degree in Korea. I had an interest for more. I wanted to study the Old Testament. It somehow interested me. I had an offer to do a doctoral program with Professor Gordon Wenham in Cheltenham in UK, and did 3 years there and completed a PhD, and that was published. And then I later on published a book on Joshua in the IVP Apollos series. And then the third book that I published is just the one we have now, a book on Numbers. And basically, my interest sort of in the Old Testament sort of sprung from a variety of sources. But one of the areas where I really developed an interest was the Pentateuch and early history of Israel, and that's what I've been working on since I've really been doing my doctoral studies. The interest sprung in many ways from me perceiving that I found academic explanations about the Pentateuch and early history of Israel rather unsatisfactory from my own perspective.
That kind of drove my my research and interest in research, and really that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years. And this third book is a kind of like a crystallization of a lot of my views and efforts on the subject area, really.
What are some of the challenges of interpreting a book like Numbers, first in terms of content and then in terms of the history of scholarship?
Yes, I think overall the book is or provides a very interesting puzzle, really the question is about how one can make sense of the materials, and is Numbers really a book on its own, or is it part of a wider entity as well? I would say the latter question is probably not immediately obvious when one reads the book, but any considerations quite quickly lead one into thinking of such things. So the question is, how can one make sense of the materials, and why was the book written? That's really, those are two sort of key issues to think about when one looks at the book. And really, then you can ask the kind of questions of who wrote it and when as well. And if one thinks of the sort of the context of this interview, I mean, what would I say to anybody who might hear the interview and be interested in the book and would like to try and read it? I myself think that it simply becomes quite fascinating when one starts to look at in detail. Starts to look at the book in detail, and you really need to make a little bit of an effort to do that. But in another sense, I don't think there is a huge effort that's involved in trying to interpret. Probably the best way to approach is to sort of start to look at the book, start reading it, and take a nice commentary and start sort of making sense of what's in there and how it all relates. And hopefully the commentary that I have written actually would help in that. The way I have written it is that in one sense I have written it as quite a simple and short piece of work, in that I'm hoping that most anybody who has an interest in the book would be able to kind of access it. So also accessibility really is something that I've had in mind, and hopefully they might be able to dig in and delve into the subject and start looking at both the Biblical Book of Numbers and the commentary, and through that engage with the materials. At another level, however, I have also points there that really are aimed at the highest levels of scholarship as well, in terms of particularly the composition of the book and the message of the book and all that sort of issues. And that, of course, ties back with the kind of interests that I've had in the subject in terms of the 20 years that I've been working on the wider issues that relate to Numbers and the Pentateuch. And I take Pentateuch together with Joshua, which is, again, not obvious for the casual reader, but because people often look at the books of Moses, which start from Genesis and end with Deuteronomy. But I take Joshua together with those books. Basically, coming back to the issue of how one can make sense of the materials and why the book was written, scholarship has asked these questions, particularly over the last 200 years and perhaps a bit more, sort of since about the 18th century, when you could consider the Pentateuchal scholarship or modern Pentateuchal scholarship as having started. And again, I have not been satisfied with the answers that have been given thus far. And really what I wanted to do with this particular book, and that ties with my overall efforts in the area, I wanted to find a solution, actually ultimately a solution that satisfies myself rather than anything else. And what I feel that with this book, I have actually found a solution that does satisfy myself. And I think that's most important as an author, I find. I'm happy with what I'm writing. I feel like that gives a good idea of how this problem, as it were, or how this issue could be solved. And of course, then, as an author, I want to share it with other people and see what they might think about my solution to these issues. And in many ways, as I indicate in the book, I would hope that readers would read it in a reflective manner. My solutions that I put forward are really ultimately just suggestions, and hopefully they can help readers engaging with the issues and really forming a picture themselves. Of course, I as an author would be very pleased and flattered if people would agree with what I've said. Nevertheless, that's the kind of thinking that I have when I have written it.
Pekka, you have a new approach to interpreting numbers, which you refer to as colonial interpretation. Sometimes you mention post-colonial interpretation. Can you explain that for us?
Yes. In many ways, colonial in this context relates to colonialism, and one has a variety of definitions that relate to colonialism. And there's quite a bit of sort of discussion that has been there around the topic. But I just going straight into one particular definition which I like. I'll just read it here. I hope I'm getting it entirely right here. Colonialism refers to projects and practices of control marshaled in interaction between societies. Interaction or interactions between societies linked in asymmetrical relations of power, and the processes of social and cultural transformation resulting from those practices. So basically, two things are very important: relationships between societies, and then on the other hand, these relations are asymmetrical in terms of power. And this is really what you would say social scientific and what would you say maybe post-colonial interpretation kind of looks at these two aspects in particular in the light of the definition there. And post-colonial really refers to sort of, I'd say, to the era which sort of started from about the end of the Second World War in the 20th century and is continuing till the present. During that time, due to many of the developments that took place around the, say, Second World War and already before and etc., many of the colonies of sort of Western powers, particularly, probably most notably Britain and France, but others as well, for instance, Portugal, those colonies became independent. And again, the colonies were societies, non-Western societies that were ruled by the Western societies. And really, the background to Western colonialism goes to the 1490s and Columbus's expeditions to Americas. Post-colonial, nevertheless, would relate to that time after the Second World War when people sort of started to become independent from these Western colonies. And on the other hand, very importantly, at the same time, there was a scholarship that arose at that time which wanted to analyze colonialism and how it had affected the world. And that's, I think, quite important. So in that sense, this book that I have here stands in that tradition of post-colonial analysis, I would say. And in biblical studies, we already have a fair bit of post-colonial analysis, but that has often been done from the perspective of how these biblical documents should be read rather than seeing the biblical documents themselves as products of colonialism. And in this mix, I would add, and that's very vital for the book, the concept of settler colonialism. And that is a particular mode of colonialism that has been identified by scholarship in the last 20 years, but in particular. Settler colonialism has its own particular modes of operation and, as you would say, targets, if that's the right word, in terms of what a settler colonial society would like to achieve, whether those targets are then explicit or implicit in settler colonial processes. And we do have such societies as USA, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and probably, for instance, Russia as well in the modern world that can be classified as settler colonial that have been analyzed. And interestingly, even if we are saying that our era is post-colonial, these settler colonial societies actually still continue, and settler colonialism continues in today's world. And one could actually indeed make a comment that colonialism in itself still lives on today, but perhaps in a different form from sort of 18th, 19th century colonialism, which was kind of surpassed by post-colonial era. For instance, American presence in the world, having all military bases and everywhere. The battle in Syria at the moment would relate to, I suppose some people use the word neocolonial, perhaps that, or to colonialism. It is not something that I have particularly analyzed in this book, but neocolonialism. However, it's worth just mentioning here, I do believe. Now, on settler-colonialism itself, as I've already mentioned, it is a particularly interesting new development in studies of colonialism, and particularly applicable to the interpretation of the Book of Numbers and Genesis Joshua as a whole. And I already mentioned that it has been developed fairly recently in the last 20 years or so. And it's a special formation of colonialism. In settler colonialism, there is the concept of settler, which is very important. And settlers come to stay, as against other type of colonial personnel who generally tend to be in the colonies only temporarily, and they usually tend to return. Another interesting aspect of settler colonialism is that settlers generally, they are founders of political orders, and they have an idea of political sovereignty that travels with them or otherwise arises in the destination. And they typically set up their own society, or otherwise they are an extension of a society of their origin. The other interesting point about, or a further interesting point about settler colonialism is that indigenous people, those who are there in the colonies where settlers come to, they generally are made to vanish instead of, as it were, exploited, as you would have in sort of normal colonialism, or often that normal colonialism could be classified as something like franchise colonialism. It doesn't mean that those people couldn't be exploited, but ultimately the target of settler colonies and settler colonialists is to make indigenous people vanish. And this vanishing can be either physical, so that people are killed or they are expelled from the area, or it can be cultural, so that the target peoples are made to conform to the society of the settlers. In effect, what happens is that a new society is established in place of an older one. And this relates to a concept called structural genocide that one academic of settler colonialism has expounded. And interestingly, it also does link with Raphael Lemkin's definition of genocide. And Raphael Lemkin was the founder of genocide studies around the time of the Second World War. And he's acknowledged as it were, almost, what would we say? Well, he's certainly acknowledged as the person who coined the term genocide. And if one reads Lemkin's work, he did basically define genocide in a wide sense, where societies are being destroyed by another society, really, roughly speaking. And that ties with settler colonialism. Now, in terms of acknowledgement of what genocide is in terms of wider societies, in fact, the UN definition of genocide defined genocide in a little bit more restrictive way. And that more restrictive way actually, interestingly, did kind of resonate with those countries who wanted to make those definitions. And often a charge has been laid that definition had to do with these societies, in fact, kind of airbrushing and hiding what they actually had done in the past themselves, let's say in the 19th century, for example, America and Britain. So there's an interesting kind of overlap and interplay between genocide studies of settler colonialism. And that interestingly then reflects onto the book. And I have tried to bring in a variety of insights, hopefully, from those areas, and I put them in the book. And anybody who reads the book can see some of the points that I'm making there. Obviously, I'm talking about those in a broad sense in this interview, but there's much more. Hopefully, I can whet some appetites here. So, coming back to the Book of Numbers, then in more specifically in a number of ways. Settler colonialism and a kind of like a structural genocide or a programmatic desire towards such structural genocide is exactly what's happening in the Book of Numbers as part of Genesis Joshua as a whole. And what I see the book together with the other books that relate to Genesis Joshua as a document, as an ancient document that legitimates settler colonialism in its ancient form, which actually is not hugely different from modern forms, ultimately, in my view. And how this happens then in the materials is that there's a movement from creation in Genesis to restoration of that creation in the new land of Israel, and particularly in Shiloh, as we can see towards the end of the book of Joshua. Interestingly, so the man is with God in the beginning, and then we do get Adam and Eve and the expulsion of man from the garden after eating the forbidden fruit. And then we see how mankind multiplies, technologies develop, and there comes a cataclysmic flood, according to the Bible, as a punishment of sins. And then mankind sort of forks out since the close of the flood, descending from Noah and his family, and then a variety of nations come around in the world, and then one person amongst those nations, Abraham, is being called by Yahweh, and he comes to Canaan, and Yahweh promises him the land as a kind of prelude to what is going to be happening later on. And then Abraham becomes a great nation, and then ultimately he migrates to Egypt, and there, well, as part of that nation-making process. And the Israelites become slaves, and Moses is being called by Yahweh, according to the documents, to lead the Israelites out of Egypt and then lead them to the promised land and get them out of slavery and then give them a new land. Just a little thing there about the land is that there are already other people in that land. And this is what really pertains to settler colonialism, in that those people who are already there are supposed to be eliminated according to the biblical documents. And then a new Israelite society is going to be put in instead. Actually, the society, in a way, is, or the principles of the society, is founded in the wilderness, and this is where the Book of Numbers actually comes in. Obviously, the founding process starts in the Book of Exodus, where you get the formation of the Tent of Meeting, where Yahweh then dwells in the midst of the people of Israel, which obviously signals the restoration of creation, where Yahweh is coming back to dwell with Israel. And obviously, it is not yet perfect there, but it is preparation. And then a number of laws are given to the Israelites for a new life in the land in a Yahvistic manner. And the Book of Numbers then depicts Leviticus depicts some of those laws, particularly Numbers depicts some of them as well. Plus then in the Book of Numbers, the Israelite community is starting to form into a, they're going to form into a community which is in a war formation in the beginning of the book. And that's being described in chapters 1 to 10 in preparation for the conquest. And then they are traversing the wilderness, and eventually they end up at Moab, on the plains of Moab, and there then Moses is giving his final sermon, and then the Book of Joshua indicates how they actually conquer the land, and then they are seen at the end of the Book of Joshua as setting up the Tent of Meeting where Yahweh dwells at Shiloh. Now, I think that some of this is somewhat mythical, some of this story. However, the idea is that there is this trust, and if one looks at settler colonial studies, often there are indications that settler societies particularly work exactly in this way. They kind of see that they have an idol which they are achieving in the new land, and that idol actually may in reality ignore all sorts of disturbing issues which are actually happening there as well, which don't fit with that idol. And I think that if one looks at the Book of Joshua, you can see that there is talk about an incomplete conquest, even though there's another strand which says the conquest is complete. So I see the strand that says the conquest is complete as an idol which the settlers are having, and yet they are kind of at the same time acknowledging that it's not quite as bright and beautiful as the book would otherwise like to indicate. And this is how I see it. And the Book of Numbers then is a one snapshot, one set of episodes, and one set of legal materials that point towards the land, which in itself, the land is a central concept in the Hexateuch, as has certainly been acknowledged by people in the past. We do know from an academic perspective that the so-called priestly materials, P and H, the priestly code and H, the holiness codes, which are fairly related and are seen to particularly be attested in the Book of Leviticus, talk about life in the new land, but they are also bits in the Book of Numbers, and then Deuteronomy as well. Moses' final speech prepares the Israelites for life in the land, and of course there are questions about what is the relationship between the PNH materials and the Deuteronomic materials, and I have comments to make on that issue as well in the Book of Numbers, particularly as it impinges on the Book of Numbers. But I do believe that the comments that I have in the Book of Numbers give pointers towards seeing how Leviticus and Exodus should be read, and how Deuteronomy should be read, and even Genesis. And obviously, I have written a book earlier on the Book of Joshua, so one can make reference to that as well. Even though for Joshua, I didn't have an explicit set of colonial interpretation there yet, I wrote it 7 years ago, that book, so my thinking wasn't quite much. Wasn't quite as much developed as it is now in the trajectory that I've been on.
Can you offer us an example from Numbers to illustrate your new interpretation?
Yes. Well, for example, the formation of the Israelite camp and the marching order, together with the census in chapters 1 to 10, shows how the Israelites prepare for a settler colonial conquest. And if we compare the material in Numbers 1 to 10 with, for instance, censuses in Mari some 500 years earlier. And this has all been pointed out. Censuses were usually done for military purposes in Mari, or at the minimum they accompanied military expeditions or military purposes. I think if one sees the Israelite censuses in the Book of Numbers, the first one of them again at I think it's Numbers, yeah, it is already in Numbers 1, and then there's a second census in Numbers 26,
right.
And interestingly there are two of them, and that is an important part of the Book of Numbers. And of course the marching, how the Israelite community should march, is clearly indicated within chapters 1 to 10. And that march is to be understood as being in a military formation, and that's interesting, and that relates to a conquest, at least in the narrative world of the book. But at least in the narrative world of the book, clearly there is an idea of a conquest. But interestingly, something that I have put in as a new point, or as a set of new points, is that I see the camp order doing more than just that. I see the people who actually would be the audience of the book as being in the land rather than people at Sinai. I mean, the narrative world is in Sinai, but actually the readership is already in the land, whenever that might be. I do have an early date that I advocate, and there are good reasons for it. Simply, I think that the document of Genesis to Numbers is clearly programmatic, and therefore I would be surprised if it was composed at a late date in ancient Israel's history, because why would you need a programmatic document at that stage when the people are already there in the land, they have had their monarchy and are working as functioning societies. Whereas in the early period of Israel, when Israel is actually just settling, a programmatic document would be just spot on, as it were, fitting in the setting where the people are. I mean, I don't mean that it couldn't have been written later, but everything to me points that it's most easy, simple, and straightforward, as it were, to see it as an early document when ancient Israel is settling there during the late early Iron Age, late Bronze Age, at the end of the late Bronze Age and during the early Iron Age in particular. So somewhere there between 1300 to 1000 BCE. Now, in order to aid that settlement then, coming back to the camp order, I see that when the Book of Numbers sees the Israelite tribes as being camped in the wilderness, actually has a purpose in forming a unity amongst the settling tribes. I mean, this could be a fairly loose confederation in a number of ways, and sometimes might not be clear what their relationship to each other might be. But if you have a tradition which tells people that we actually were unity, we are a unity, and we were there in the wilderness, we were camped there, we were there with Moses, we were there around the central sanctuary, and we were all united there. If you have that kind of thinking, that would help people to get a feeling of being part of a greater Israel. And I believe that this is one of the purposes of the author of the Book of Numbers, and of course Genesis, Joshua as a whole. And if one thinks, for instance, of those tribes that were settling, say, in Galilee and in the north, it would be quite difficult for them to interact with some of the tribes who'd be in the central area, let's say Shiloh, and perhaps in the south as well, because of the way the land lies. Ancient technologies would not enable people to travel a whole lot. Perhaps stories would travel to some extent. So these kind of stories of unity could help them think that we are part of Israel, and we are all descendants of Abraham, and we were all in the wilderness. And interestingly, in the Pentateuch, actually, there are very few actual traditions about, let's say, forefathers that pertain to the northern tribes, as in comparison to, let's say, those from the central area or in the south, in Judah. So putting it all together in this kind of document could help that everybody could still somehow, even if some parts of the country and the doings of the ancestors might be more emphasized, everybody could feel that they are unity. I mean, I think this is what the authors of the document were trying to achieve.
I've also come to see the arrangement of the camp as an ideal portrait, the first historic expression of the covenant community. There are reflexes of Israel's camp in the vision Ezekiel has of the new temple in Jerusalem in Ezekiel chapter 40 through 48, but also in the book of Revelation and in the vision of the new Jerusalem. The city of God there seems also to echo the arrangement of the camp around God's central dwelling place.
That's right. It's a pervasive concept that really runs through all of the biblical documents. I think that is interesting. And again, it starts from paradise, really, where Yahweh is with people, and then that is ruptured, and then there's some kind of restoration of that there that is happening, or at least desired, and then that is happening actually at Sinai, and then at Shiloh, and then with the new temple of David, then Ezekiel envisions a new temple, and then that carries over into the New Testament for Christians and into the New Jerusalem, into the concept of New Jerusalem. Yes, I do think that. And I feel like the settler colonial interpretation that I'm doing perfectly fits with all this. I don't see there to be any contradiction with any of this. Obviously, when we read, or when one reads these documents as Christian, then there is an issue of violence which pertains to settler colonialism. And I have some thoughts on that. I can give those in a few moments, perhaps, if we get there as part of the discussion.
How about explaining for us your view of composition in terms of the Hexateuch, Genesis through the book of Joshua?
Yes. Well, it kind of ties with my thinking about scholarship and problems that scholarship has in relation to the book. And basically, on pages 8 to 11 of the book, I more or less outline the main problems that current scholarship does have. And actually, I think it is very important for people to realize that the views that current scholarship has does have a do have a history. And really, I have tried to have a little bit of a survey of that history as well in the commentary. And really, I think that sort of three milestones, as it were, in that history are very significant. One is the division of, I would say, the Pentateuch, and perhaps really Joshua as well, is the division of this book into sources, which sort of happened since the 18th century, let's say, and the French physician Jan Astruc, even though there would have been a bit of precursors to him as well, but in effect. And then the next stage was the anchoring of the Book of Deuteronomy into the 7th century and the reform of Josiah by De Wette in Germany in early 19th century. And then the third stage was the late dating of the priestly materials, which were identified as one source in scholarship. And this late dating was done by Wellhausen. And that sort of formed a framework for understanding the Pentateuch. But now, obviously, there are a lot of details that that relate to the scholarship, and Wellhausen's work was in the sort of 1860s, 1870s, and I'm just skipping here sort of 130 years of history very quickly. But with any of the modifications, etc., nevertheless, I think the main problems that we have at the moment with Pentateuchal scholarship are, first of all, the lack of consensus about anything. Simply, even if there was a consensus, you could, of course, question it. But particularly as there is a lack of consensus about particularly sources and their division, you can really ask the question of how authoritative is a theory like this. Then we have a very important problem in that there is a discrepancy between the canonical order and the order of postulated order of composition of the sources. In canonical order, priestly materials come sort of in the middle part of the Pentateuch or Genesis Joshua, whereas according to the critical consensus, the priestly materials were composed at the very late stage. So now, why then we in the narrative order have the priestly materials presented about midway, and then Deuteronomy, which is supposedly the earlier document, kind of is put on top of them as a sort of later document that builds on the priestly materials in the narrative order? It's a clear discrepancy, and I think the sort of what you call Wellhausenian scholarship has not been able to resolve this issue, and it's hardly been asked until recently. And there's a beautiful German thesis by a young scholar, Benjamin Kilcher, which has been dealing with this issue and suggested a very nice set of solutions to the order of the codes and the relationship of these codes. And I have relied on his insights quite a bit in the commentary. A further problem is that the Wellhausenian approaches, and in fact, this is a kind of consensus at the moment, even though not 100%, but more or less, that there is an idea of a development of concepts and institutions from simple to complex. And I think this is completely wrong. I would go as far as to say that I think this is completely wrong to assume that. And I do believe that one of the reasons why this thinking is there is that it fitted sort of 19th century thinking about progress of science, the progress of the West, and the kind of idea that the West is now very advanced in comparison to the rest of the world, whether in present time or then present time, or whether in terms of history. And if you put those Israelite documents under a particular spin, you can get an idea of development from simple to complex again. But is it right? This is the question that I am very much thinking of, and I think it simply isn't right. And also, one of the reasons why I think it's not right is that we simply can see from the second millennium ancient Near East otherwise that societies are complex and that they have complex concerns and even ritual materials that are very complex of exactly the same level, at the very least, more or less the same level as the sort of Israelite priestly materials, for instance, the Hittite rituals, for instance, from Kisuwatna, for example. So really, I feel like that kind of concept is there in the minds of people, and I feel like that idea of development, it fits very well with Western culture, which may still think, at least in pockets today, that other people than Westerners are less able and less intelligent and all of that. Not everybody will think that, but there are people still who think that way. And it fits that kind of mindset. And I do believe that if one thinks of biblical studies, it's a relatively isolated field and has been able to be in its ivory tower since the 19th century. And what it has done is that it has kept this mindset, which I'm just described, and it's been able to be relatively isolated from anything else in scholarship. And then there's been an inertia that has also formed a 200-year tradition, 200 years or so tradition, maybe 150 as well, around there, that is still very much in effect in many ways in the scholarship. And it's something that needs to be changed. That's my view. And hopefully my book here is one little contribution towards helping to change the situation. The other issue that I wanted to highlight was number four, as it were, to say, is that the sociocritical theories tend to be very complicated. And when one thinks of the document Genesis to Joshua, to my mind, it presents a narrative more or less, even if it does have all the legal materials, etc., interspersed in between. And one really wonders, could such a narrative and such an entity have just been formed by sort of haphazard and almost random processes, in a manner of speaking, as sort of Wellhausenian scholarship does tend to think, and through all sorts of complicated redactional additions, addition, etc. And I just feel like it defies the kind of thing that could sit down somewhere, or a couple of authors could sit down somewhere and actually create something like this and create a narrative. I don't see anywhere else, really, any books or literary works that would have been formed in such a haphazard manner. Okay, we do know that the Gilgamesh epic, for instance, which has often been considered as a comparator, was formed through additions and subtractions. But it seems that it first had a set of initial narratives somewhere there in the late third millennium. And then those were put together into an overarching story. And then only after that you had some additional subtractions, which didn't necessarily really change the overall story. So I've been kind of tracing the possibility that something like that could have happened here with the Book of Numbers and Genesis Joshua. And I think the interpretation I give is broadly in line with that kind of approach. I mean, I can't go into more details. Again, people can refer to the commentary for some further exposition on these issues. But anyway, I do just feel like you need to find some kind of organic way. Again, another example would be the Book of Jeremiah, which we know that is a little bit of a haphazard composition. So in that sense, that's possible, I should think so, because we have the Greek text and the Hebrew text, and they are quite divergent, all of this. But if Jeremiah or some prophetic books are more of an anthology, should we assume this for Genesis, Joshua, and including Numbers? I think not, and I think that there is a simpler alternative. And finally, the fifth issue that I have as a problem is that there's a clearly a stylistic break between Numbers and Deuteronomy. So sort of Genesis and Numbers, they can be understood as being a mix of material that have been in past scholarship seen as two narrative sources of Yahwist and Elohist, and then the priestly source, and perhaps the age, the holiness source, together with the priestly source. And then we have another block, as it were, which is which relates to Deuteronomy and Joshua. And those are sort of more in a Deuteronomistic style, which also applies that same style to Judges to 2 Kings. And in fact, because Deuteronomy to 2 Kings is in a similar style, that led to the famous theory by Martin North, where he suggested in the 1940s that they were a single work produced in the Babylonian exile. And I do generally, I feel that this break hasn't been sufficiently accounted for by any of the theories. And this kind of leads to my sort of idea about composition. In fact, coming back to North, his hypothesis was very popular sort of after the 1940s, but it has come in under questions since then, particularly since the sort of 1980s Westermann's book on the issue on Deuteronomistic history in Germany. And we also have to keep in mind in this context that before Martin North's Deuteronomistic history theory, people did think of things in terms of Exodus, Genesis to Joshua. But again, they still had a bit of a problem with accounting with the break between Genesis to Numbers and then Deuteronomy and Joshua. After Doth's theory was put under questioning, a new set of approaches has been proposed in Germany over the last, say, sort of 10, 15, 20 years, a so-called redactional layers approach. And in effect, the idea of the redactional layers approach is that there is a Hexateuch, but this was kind of produced by people putting in, as it were, redactional layers over the course of time. And that's how it was almost like a layers of snow falling at different times and forming the whole document in a sense. Now, my problem with those redactional layers approaches is that they still go by the Wellhausenian scheme of development from simple to complex. And then in another sense, they, to my mind, do not take seriously enough some kind of narrative unity that is there from Genesis to Joshua, and also more or less consider it as a result of some haphazard processes, even if deterministic processes for them, I suppose it's fair to say. But it just to me, it again seems like it treats a piece of literature as something that's coming together piecemeal without really strong overarching authorial intention. And sort of coming back in that the kind of entity or unity or narrative progression that has been detected through Genesis Joshua, I sort of tend to think of Jacob Milgrom's proposal of a kind of chiastic structure through the whole work, which indicates a kind of mirroring of things through the whole. And I think that shows a sort of or fits together with the idea of progression from paradise to the promised land, as we've just chatted about, and in kind of in the sense of mirror images in terms of an ancient, more or less unified composition. Now, I do know that many people don't quite agree with Milgrom's chiasm, but I think the chiasm is at least is useful at least as a heuristic device, which shows that the composition as a whole does make sense. And again, as I've already mentioned, this kind of progression does fit perfectly with the settler colonial interpretation. So, keeping all this in mind, I feel when one takes all of the issues that I've just outlined above, there's quite an easy and straightforward solution. One can think that Genesis Numbers is one block and Deuteronomy and Joshua are another block here. Keeping in mind also that we don't need to think that Judges and Samuel and Kings need to be part of the same composition, even though they do continue the story sort of in a similar style. But we don't need to think of them as part of the composition of Genesis to Joshua. So, again, Genesis to Numbers is one block in terms of style and the kind of materials that have been put in, and then Deuteronomy and Joshua is another block. And I feel like if you then think that actually two people were working together, one had the one did Genesis to Numbers, the other one did Deuteronomy and Joshua, then you can account for the composition quite nicely. And if they work together, you can account for the unity of the composition quite nicely. Nevertheless, it doesn't take away the fact or the idea that these people did use sources. And I have a detailed chart to indicate, at least in outlines, maybe paradoxical as it may sound, how the composition could have resulted from the sources, how the authors could have used those sources to put things together. And funnily enough, a couple of little points should be added. The death of Moses, to my mind, actually in Deuteronomy, can be seen as having been produced by the first author, because it's in the style of the narratives of Genesis to Numbers. And then he probably just passed it on to the other author who put it in. And then the second author, Deuteronomistic author, he put in Moses' speech, took in the laws, and then he did Joshua as well. And for Joshua, he took some, or rather, he was aware of some of the priestly materials and incorporated them, applied to the book of Joshua. And now, another important point to keep in mind here is that Genesis is a little bit different. It has less priestly material, even though it does have some, particularly in Genesis 1 to 11. And then it has all the patriarchal narratives. And I see this part of the composition, that is the book of Genesis, as an introduction, as a prologue to Exodus and what follows. And other people have call it a prologue, like Jonathan Seeters in his prologue to history, I think it was, that was the name of the book where he talked about Genesis. And if one thinks of, for instance, the recent well-known book Lord of the Rings, you do have The Hobbit first, and then you get The Lord of the Rings, and they are both by the same author, but just talk about different things and possibly go in a little bit differing styles as well, and in terms of content matter and when things happened. Obviously, we don't have to have a complete analogy, but I think there is sufficient analogy there to suggest this. That's how you can see the composition.
Pekka, what would you say is the central message of Numbers?
Okay, well, I think Numbers, again, I'm repeating this to ad absurdum. I guess that's the expression, but nevertheless, it should be seen in the context of Genesis Numbers and its settler colonial interpretation. And in the book and in the wider work, the presence of the Israelites in the land is legitimated, and they are encouraged to keep settling the land within a Yahwistic framework. But specifically, the murmuring traditions are one special way of emphasizing that it's very important to be faithful to Yahweh. And obviously, there is a punishment of the first generation, and then only the second generation can reach the land. And of course, the book of Deuteronomy, however, as well, plays on this issue. But nevertheless, in Numbers, we can see how the first generation doesn't want to enter the land, and then they cannot. It's only their children who can. And that is, to my mind, that emphasizes that people who read the book should not be like the first generation that cannot enter the land. They should be like the second generation who could enter the land, and they should be encouraged to do things right. The legal and ritual materials, they do link with Leviticus from a literary and conceptual perspective, and with emphasis particularly on the Levites in the Book of Numbers. And the camp order, as I've already mentioned, helps towards the concept of the unity of the Israelites. Now, I thought I'd add a few comments from a reader response perspective. I think in many ways, when we read those books, they should alert us towards reflecting on how much the world and how much our Christian religion, together with Judaism and perhaps Islam, how much they have been actually shaped by colonialism and accompanying violence. And the fact that these are sacred texts for these religions is, to my mind, actually quite staggering. One way of obviously dealing with it would be just simply deny the violent aspects. But I do think that we have to read the texts as they have come to us and try to find what the text said to the original audience. And then if we have a religious background, try to see how we can read them then as people who follow a particular religion. And also, I do think that there is a political message in these texts, from a reader response criticism. And I think that the texts also do help us see that religion and politics are generally intertwined, perhaps less in our modern sort of enlightenment or post-enlightenment societies. But nevertheless, they are still pertinent. I think we can read against the grain, as it were, so as to help the world become more just and fair. And I don't think we should read them as legitimating documents for modern colonialism and violence. But then as a Christian, perhaps in a sort of, if one goes to modern theology, sort of in a Schleiermacherian sense, perhaps the documents or the texts from the sort of Mosaic period, they demonstrate a limited amount of God consciousness, if you could use that word, that then increases in the New Testament, and whichever way one then thinks of the Galilean carpenter Jesus. And on the other hand, there is, of course, a possibility of a completely secular reading where we just think that religion was part of the ancient world and it was used for legitimating violence and as simply as part of world history from a particular time where these documents came about and the times that they portray. That's for people to try and think of how they want to read. And I think that's really for the readers to decide. But those are just my thoughts. Some of these thoughts are not in the book, actually, but I thought I'd just make them. I've been reflecting on things also after the book was published.
Before we let you go, Pekka, can you tell us about any other projects you're working on?
Okay. I'm working currently on a monograph on migration and colonialism in late second millennium Levant and its environs. And one part of the project for me is to see how ancient Israel is part of the wider developments in the ancient world and the ancient Near East at the time. And the other societies included the Arameans, the Philistines, the Assyrians, the Hittites, Near Hittites, and the Egyptians. But otherwise, my interest is on the whole in world history, because I do believe these documents and all these other things that I'm just mentioning there are part of world history and have and we have a reason to study them just simply to know about world history and how the world we are living now in has been shaped by developments in the past. But with particularly the ancient Israelite documents, since they have been passed through history when the rest of the remains, as it were, from the ancient Near East were buried under ruins for millennia, they have a special place in world history, obviously feeding into world religions as well, two or three of today's world's main religions. But again, the ancient Near East has been discovered, and I think there's an interplay, as it were, if that's the right way to express, between these two streams. and I think it's fascinating, and that's what I hope to do for my next project. I also do some work on the study of ritual and other sociological and anthropological approaches to biblical interpretation and study of the wider ancient Near East.
That all sounds great, and all the best to you on those labors. Thank you, Pekka, for spending time with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Pekka Pitkanen talk about his recent book, A Commentary on the Book of Numbers, published by Routledge in 2017. You'll find a link to it on our website. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.